We're going to introduce, as I'm told, we normally introduce ourselves. And so we'll go around the room and introduce who you are, what your capacity is. I'm Eileen Quiring, and I'm the council chair and now chair of this committee. So.
I'm Janice Koch. I'm with Clark County Public Health, and I'm representing Clark County Public Health. I'm the Environmental Public Health Director. I'm also representing Clark County Community Services. And I am on call this week, so if I get a phone call, I will have to step out to take it. I apologize in advance. Thank you.
I'm Michael Green, Superintendent of Woodland Public Schools.
Sharon Cruz, Academic Director, College of Education, WSUV.
Mark Ross, Superintendent, Battleground.
Heidi Rosenberg, Director of Capital Programs at Cameron School District.
Mary Templeton, Superintendent of Washougal School District.
I'm Todd Hornstein, Assistant Superintendent for Vancouver Schools.
Jennifer Baker, President of Columbia River Economic Development Council.
Mitch Nichols, Community Development, Clark County.
Matt Herman, Transportation Planner with Clark County Public Works.
I'm Sharon Lumontobin with Clark County Community Planning.
And I'm Jenna Kay with Clark County Community.
Julie Olson, Clark County Council. And we have some new members, so welcome Hawkinson School District, right?
Washougal.
I'm sorry, Washougal. Yeah. And Jennifer Baker with CRDC. And Todd, you haven't been here before, have you?
I just missed the last one.
Okay.
Okay, we have some meeting notes from the November meeting to review and adopt. Yeah, I've had time to look those over. Do we have enough of a?
Yeah, we have sufficient. Enough.
Okay. Yep. All right. You've had sufficient time to look them over. I would entertain a motion to accept them.
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded to accept the Clark County School Advisory Committee meeting notes from November 5th, 2018. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing and seeing none, the motion. Okay, review of 2019 schedule and topics. Okay.
So the next sheet in your packet just sort of outlines the plan for this year as was discussed at the November meeting. So today's meeting will be focused on growth and planning in the county, and then in the fall, shortly after this meeting, we'll work on scheduling the fall meeting, and that will be focused on legislation.
With regard to the legislation, it would be more kind of what school districts, what their interests are and potential legislative activities for 2020.
Correct. And our plan was to work with Lindsay.
Okay.
Preparation for that presentation.
I was going to say that, too. Will it be prior to September, before school starts?
Oh, in terms of scheduling? Yes.
My understanding from previous discussions was the thought was early fall, like maybe October.
Okay.
But maybe good to check with the group if that still sounds like okay timing.
School Directors Association has their annual legislative conference. This last year was September 20th, so that week. And usually around that window is when board set a legislative agenda. So after that.
So it would be better after. Okay.
Okay. So I'll work on scheduling.
All right. Okay. Community development update. Mitch Nichols, take it away.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity to come back and speak with you. What we've done since our last meeting, I did have an opportunity to visit briefly with Tyson Bowman at Green Mountain and take a look at some of the challenges they faced, some of the works that they want to do on their property. And want to confirm with everybody that we still have our process together for the staff review for our team. So we have our team together for the school district review, and that's still available to everybody to handle on a case-by-case basis anything that we need to do to support your efforts as you develop your capital plans or look toward the future. Speaking of that, we have prepared for each of the 9 districts that we have here, WSU exclusive, sorry about that. a spreadsheet that shows the development, residential development 2014 through 2019, and provides a spreadsheet list of projects, residential projects that are currently permitted in your districts. And these are the description or the status of the process is captured in the description. There are various stages of development in and around these projects, and if you don't have this, it's on its way. This will help inform your decision making. This will help inform your student counts, hopefully, to give you an idea of how many new residences there'll be in your district, how many students that may, doing the demographics that you normally do to make those assessments, determine how many kids you can expect with each coming school year. The typical life cycle for these projects can be pretty long, starting with the initial development process on land use, depending on what zoning processes they have to go through in order to get development done. It can be between 5 and 7 years out on the outer end, and as quickly as 2 to 3 years on the short end. So it's helpful to understand when you have questions about a particular development, especially as it relates to a school in the nearby area that would be impacted, finding out exactly when this project is expected and when the build-out will occur is important information for you to have. I'll give you all a minute to kind of look through it and develop any questions you might have. I've got 15 minutes, so I want to take advantage of that and answer as many questions as I can for you. One of the questions I have for you is how frequently you would like this report updated. This is it's important information, and it is subject to change on a monthly basis, depending on who's walking in the door with applications.
So you don't have a grand total for each of the districts totaled up at the bottom?
I don't. We didn't go that far into it. So each of the number of units in the fourth column from the right. Basically tells you how many units, and these are all based on single family occupancy. And so the makeup of the family is the demographic that may be specific to the school district. I can't tell you that exactly.
If these are updated monthly?
That's the question to the group, is how often would you like them updated?
Well, from Vancouver's standpoint, monthly would be great.
Monthly, okay. Yeah.
Dates associated with them?
So, not really, and that's the challenge here, is that we can tell you what part of the process they're in, but actual date specific is difficult to determine because there's a lot of factors and things influencing the development and the development process.
So I'm trying to understand what part of the process they're in.
Sure.
How does it
so have you got an example I can look at, or? Want to read one?
There just doesn't seem to be a column that says in development review or in site plan review or in building or in.
Okay, so in the last column, it's called description.
Mm-hmm.
That describes pretty much where the process is.
Okay.
So if you look at, depending on which one you're looking at, but one I'm looking at says site plan for proposal to add 25 units. One building, clubhouse, parking, and storm facility to existing 90-unit apartment complex. Assuming a site plan review, is, as far as the process is concerned, happens early in the process, dependent on the ability of the developer to build that property out and get the permits needed, that could take up to 2 years for a project that size. It's not huge. But it still may have complexities, traffic impacts, and so forth that need to be mitigated.
Have they been assigned to a planner at this stage?
If they're in this stage, yes, they would have been. If they've actually applied for a permit, they have been assigned to staff.
Could that information be included? So there's a
as to which staff members impacted?
Well, or which planner is that would be helpful.
Okay.
So I heard that you wanted an update, monthly update. If some of these projects are years in the making, how would you update that monthly? Could there be simplified way of denoting which one, or does a whole spreadsheet go in?
It's possible we could track them based on action. And so if there's an action on a particular application in a month, then that notification would be specific to that project would go out instead of updating the entire list.
Yeah, okay.
If it were on GIS or some kind of a map format, we could just look it up. If we knew you had them updated, we could just look it up, too. That's a possibility.
That's a good observation.
So that would be my question. So I'm assuming the PLD is, and it has a 2014-15, that's the year they applied, because these are 5 years worth of projects. So it doesn't really tell me when it says, and under the description, the applicant is requesting, but that was back in 2015.
Some of those are still in the request. I mean, that's exactly where it's
so that's the last action then. That would, okay. Another,
if we can move these to the permit stage, we'll do that. If
okay.
We say building permit is active, that okay. Gives you an idea of very closely when it's going to be completed.
Does the size of the division of the property, the lot size, give you an idea of the cost of the home?
No.
What we're finding is our projections are way off of our growth in Battleground. We budget to budget, we're down about 400 students, and we don't know why, because there's so much building, but our assumptions are that because the homes are more expensive, that families are with small children aren't moving into those homes, and so there's a delay of getting kids into the system. So I don't know how you rectify that with so many lots and parcels coming in, how we can determine, because I know they've lowered the average family size per household, I think that's kind of lowered a little bit, but how do we even determine, you know, how many students we're getting? I know you go by the average, but it seems like the more expensive a home is, the fewer students we're seeing out of that within the last 3 or 4 years. So
we really don't get into asking the applicants who they're marketing their homes to. Mm-hmm. We do know that, I mean, as an example, that if you have a riverfront property that you're probably marketing toward a professional that's got a lot of disposable income, and that's typically not the case with families, with, you know, people with children. So in the rural areas, the outlying areas where you have the very large residential lots, those are typically people that have amassed quite a bit of disposable income and are able to do things that you couldn't do as a younger family. It's tough, but I would, if you've got a demographer, I would suggest you sit down and talk with them and find a way to get to that.
Yeah, it's almost a matter of driving around to the subdivisions and seeing, you know, the starting price is, you know, $300,000 versus the starting price of $500,000. Then we know probably going to see younger families in the lower cost homes to start with.
What we do know, when we look at the valuations, we assign valuations based on the cost per square foot of construction, and we find that houses are selling pretty typically above that, mm-hmm. and substantially, maybe 20% higher than the estimated value in the permit application. So, again, hard to tell who can afford what anymore.
Right. Thank you.
And then you've got all the new multifamily, may lend itself more toward.
Those are almost easier to predict that we will see families in those areas, and that's where we're seeing our growth in the south end along 503 and the apartments on the east side, but it's really now with the home sites around Pleasant Valley, we're not seeing the growth. We actually have seen a reduction in the growth of the Pleasant Valley schools, even though there's developments all around there. So it's very surprising to listen. It does show the multifamily, so that's easier than.
The question about GIS, doing an actual GIS layer, is intriguing. Mm-hmm. We just, by virtue of great good fortune, GIS has joined our portfolio as in community development. So that's an asset we have directly adjacent to the work that we're doing. So that's a good place for us to start with some of this.
Questions or comments?
I'm sorry. You're not counting anything in any of the city limits.
Well, Vancouver is included, and Vancouver School District is included. So is Vancouver School District serve anything outside of the urban area of Vancouver?
I'm just I was just looking at Ridgefield, and I'm just in terms of what we've identified. We're not identifying anything inside the city limits because obviously we
don't. No, not as far as a, right, exactly. Not a
school district's
right.
Measure where this growth is coming.
Yeah, we're only capturing county projects. That's correct.
Yeah, is there not capturing projects in the city? Yes.
Is that all the questions?
Yes, that's much like. Yeah. If there are no other questions of Mitch.
Right, and that's not.
We could use him, but I don't know whether when we're going to have this. Is it going to be monthly?
Yeah, I mean, there's
monthly.
Okay. Right. Okay. Community planning update.
In your packet at your seat. And we already introduced ourselves, but we're all, Matt, Sharon, and I are all long-range planners. And so we are working on projects related to the Growth Management Act and County's Comprehensive Plan. And so we're going to run through projects that were that are slated to come before the council this year that might have some kind of impact on schools. And so, we'll get to the channel and we'll start us off.
Okay. Next slide. Want to do that? Yeah, thank you. I'm going to twist and turn. So I'm just going to share with you the proposals which have the potential for over 30 units. And it's potential because these are still pending council approval. So the first one is in the Evergreen School District, and it has a potential for 40 units coming in. This is a proposal to rezone community commercial into low-density residential. And the next one is in Battleground School District. And this is a 70-acre parcel. And pending council approval, this has the potential for 240 units because this is currently zoned business park, and it could be rezoned to R110 urban low residential. And the last one is the Vancouver School District, which has the potential for 36 units on 2 acres, currently zoned R16, and it could be rezoned to R18, which is urban medium density. And then this is just an update on any residentially zoned property that is converting to commercial. We only have one this year. It's a single family dwelling. It's in the Vancouver School District.
Sharon, have these been before the Planning Commission?
Not yet. August.
August?
Yeah.
August?
Okay. Yes. And they'll come before Council in the fall, and they wouldn't be approved until February 2020.
participate in that process?
So you will be emailed. You'll be on the emailing list when it's going to the Planning Commission hearing and the council hearing. So you'd have an opportunity to provide public comment or oral written testimony if you wanted to. Or you could send, you know, yeah, basically, the two public hearings.
Okay, so I'm going to walk through some more of our docket projects that we're working on. So, as many of you in the room may know, several of the school districts are updating their capital facility plans this year. So, once those get approved by your school boards, then they will come before the Planning Commission. And right now we're scheduled to, we're going to carry them all through the process together on the same timeline. So, those will come to the Planning Commission in early summer. So, the hearing is scheduled for mid-July right now, and then it would come before the council in the fall. Another school project we're working on this year is regarding the zoning of school properties. So right now, most school properties are zoned as public facilities, and there's been a request from the school districts to revert that zoning back to what it was prior to that designation. So working on that. And I don't know, Marnie, if you have anything you want to add on either of the last project or this one. Okay. And that project is scheduled to go to Planning Commission also in early summer, and then it will go before the County Council in the fall.
I'm curious, when was it changed to public facility? And why is it being requested to return to whatever zoning it was?
Sure. So Marnie, if you want to approach the table, but I'll give the high level answer is in 2016, with the 2016 comp plan update, that's when the change happened. And then Marnie, if maybe you want to summarize why.
Sure. When the change happened, the school districts met with county staff and were supportive of the rezone, but at the time we talked about regulations that would implement the PF zone and that would then be consistently applied to schools. So we would have consistent setbacks, height limits, stormwater, sign, landscaping standards. As the county got into trying to adopt regulations to implement the PF zone, there were so many different uses that would have to be addressed. It was hard, as I understand it, from the county staff perspective, to come up with those standards. For example, you might be able to identify a setback standard that worked well for all schools in the PF zone, but that setback standard might not work for jails or libraries or police stations. So right now what you have is a PF zone, which then says follow the regulations that were in place for the zoning before it was zoned PF. So then that's harder for your own staff in community development when they get school applications to go, okay, what was it zoned before we rezoned at PF? Oh, residential. Okay, let's go look at residential standards. What are they? So it just seemed like we weren't able to accomplish what you had initially hoped to accomplish with the PF zone.
Another project that's in the works is regarding updating the county's sewer regulations. And so right now, county development code already allows sewer service to serve K-12 public schools outside of the urban growth boundary. There was a new law passed in 2017. And so the code change that would be proposed through this project is really to update the code to reference the new law, but won't actually be having won't be changing whether schools can access sewer or not outside. And that's slated to go to Planning Commission in June, and then it will go before the County Council after that. Tomorrow, there is a council hearing regarding a proposed amendment for university districts. And the proposal that's being considered is to add dormitories as an allowed use in university districts. Matt's going to take it from here.
So something that's been in the news recently has been the urban holding at the 179th interchange. Urban holding is shown as the green hatch mark on the map behind me. It's approximately 2,200 acres. This area was added to the Vancouver urban growth area in 2004 and 2006, and it currently has this urban holding overlay placed on it. That urban holding overlay is basically a restrictor plate for urban level development in the area. And that restrictor plate is there because the urban services aren't in place to serve that urban development. Most notably, it's transportation issues. Transportation infrastructure doesn't have the capacity to serve the urban level development that's anticipated in the area. Of that urban holding area, approximately 57% of that is in the Ridgefield School District that's shown in blue in that map behind me, 35% in the Battleground School District, and 9% in the Vancouver Urban or School District. And that's just a small section from approximately 154th to the south.
Matt, do you have broken out what the zoning is?
Yeah.
Some is commercial,
mainly around the interchange. It's commercial and industrial. And then from the commercial and industrial, there's a buffer of office residential zoning, and then residential zoning from the periphery of the urban holding area. Most of it is residential development. So I will get into details about how that impacts and how you've been planning for that, those impacts. So I talked about the necessary infrastructure to serve that. The total of this is approximately $116 million, of which $50.5 million is state projects. Those state projects are the interchange replacement. This was awarded by the legislature to WashDOT Southwest Region in 2016, and an additional $500,000 was added after that. But of the total 116, $66 million is Clark County's responsibility. Though that specific transportation infrastructure that accounts for that $66 million are for five different projects. One of them is 179th Street from Delfell, which is west of the interchange, to 15th Avenue east of the interchange. If you know from driving through this area, it's three lanes underneath the interchange that can accommodate the urban level traffic that we're anticipating. Another project is 15th Avenue from the intersection at 15th and 179th. To 10th Avenue. This is kind of a serpentine road that will ultimately connect it and divert the intersection at 10th Avenue, 179th, further to the east. Two intersection projects are necessary, 29th Avenue at 179th and 50th Avenue at 179th. And then finally, 10th Avenue from 149th to 154th. As you know, the bridge over Whipple Creek was recently improved, but there's a section south of that that needs to be improved as well. So the reason behind this is a top priority for the councilors to fund these necessary improvements and ultimately lift urban holding in the area. It's a big economic development opportunity for the county. But in order to fund those improvements, we've been going through a series of workshops with necessary stakeholders in order to find funding and allocate the necessary resources to fund those projects. Currently, the committee has concluded its recommendation and has a recommended option for the county council to consider. We're looking at a date of May 7th for that to go in front of the county council for consideration and for them to ultimately choose an option that they feel could reasonably fund those necessary projects. When they do that, we're going to begin the process of removing the urban holding in that area. That's where the impacts come specifically to your school districts.
And how long does something like that take?
So the urban holding removal is a process that is tied to our comprehensive plan. So it would ultimately conclude potentially this year and be able to be removed in February of 2020 if that is reasonably funded.
Construction and all that is...
Construction would be much further away. The actual construction of those projects would, those local projects would begin in anticipated 2023.
Matt, excuse me, the slide that's on the screen now with the sources, Eric Hovey, do you happen to know if those were broken down by school district?
This data was not broken down by, this was a specific just to urban holding. Just the entire urban
home. When was the study done?
It was done in, I believe, last year or the year before. Okay. So with the capital facilities plan that we currently have in the county, the Ridgefield School District, and I checked with Eric Hovey about this, the enrollment forecasts were done anticipating the development of that urban holding area. That urban holding area was and always has been anticipated to be removed in the comprehensive plan horizon year. So the enrollment projections that were a part of the capital facilities plan were based on that removal. That's true with the Ridgefield School District as well as the Battleground School District. Eric Hovey did not do the Battleground School District capital facilities plan, but your consultant that I've conferred with has.
I'm sorry I'm late. Mike Nerland, ESD 112. Do school districts have the opportunity to purchase property within that urban holding before it goes out to private companies for purchase?
The urban holding overlay does not restrict the sale of properties. School district can buy and purchase land in anticipation of the development of that area.
And we don't own, it's all privately owned currently. It's just, we just have an overlay over the top that doesn't allow development. We don't, county doesn't own the property.
Okay. It's a difficult situation for school districts to buy property because they can only go, I think it's 10% over the assessed value. And when we're talking about construction and the profitability for private companies to come in and purchase this, it puts the districts at a huge disadvantage when they're looking at buying property to keep up with future growth. And, you know, we're looking at Battleground especially, that already the facilities are extremely crunched, and Ridgefield has been able to pass a bond. They didn't, you know, this last time. But is there any way that our county and our city governments can provide some sort of a advantage to school districts, but a way where they can be competitive with private companies? Because having been involved in purchasing property from school districts when I was superintendent in Camas, it is a huge challenge to compete against any sort of private company that wants to come in, and they know they're going to make, you know, quite a bit of money. So if there's any way that that playing field could be leveled a little bit for the school districts, I think that would be such a benefit to our county, our communities, our school districts.
Is it state legislation that governs the 10% over assessed value? Yeah. That would be who you would...
I think it's appraised value.
Yeah, appraised value.
Appraised, not... Oh, okay. That's very different.
Appraised value.
So, yeah. I would say more than anything, it could be... What we're doing here today is giving you a heads up. That's one thing that's good. And what's good about this advisory committee is that you can see what's coming, even though it is years down the line. For instance, all these, you know, these permits that are in various stages, which many are years away, as well as this urban holding as far as actual construction. So it gives you a heads up, but May 7th, you know, and as we move forward, this is going to be known, you know, throughout the community, certainly the development community. But if you were to have so that's what I see as the advantage from the county, is to let you know what's happening or even what could be happening and, you know, et cetera. But I would talk to your state legislators as these developments take place, you think that you need more than 10% above.
Of course, the challenges for school districts are passing
bonds. To even find that.
Passing bonds, trying to get the funding for land and buildings. Yeah. And
so just to back up, I mentioned the capital facilities plan. That capital facilities plan is tied to your SIFs. So capital facilities plan puts the amount of money that's necessary to build your infrastructure and then translates that into SIFs that are charged on multifamily and single family developments.
Yeah, I think you're going to have to update your costs. That's not.
Yeah. That.
Construction cost, was this last year that they did? Or even 2 years ago?
So I believe Jenna mentioned the capital facilities plan updates. So once those get updated and accepted by the county, we'll update our SIFs accordingly and charge the amount that's tied to your adopted and approved capital facilities plan.
Any
One final update, since this is the first time we've given a presentation like this to this group, we just wanted to mention that last year in 2018, that the County Council adopted some development code changes related to accessory dwelling units and cottage housing to remove some barriers to building those types of development. So that went into effect in early 2018, I think out of that, for instance, rural accessory dwelling units are now allowed in the county as long as they're attached to the primary residence, which weren't before. And also there was a reduction in the impact fees for accessory dwelling units to help reduce barriers to building those. And that's it for our updates. So,
any questions before we move to the... Okay. Wrap up. This all in a nice package. See what we're going to do for our next meeting.
I captured the item that Mitch is going to follow up on regarding providing more regular updates on what's going on with development. And then I'll be scheduling our next meeting focused on legislation. Anything else that either anyone heard that we missed or that we want to make sure we're tracking?
And you're going to check on maybe the GIS?
Yes, I am going to check on the GIS and look at what we can post online to make it accessible more. As the school year starts this year and through 2020, I want to begin to visit each of your districts in person during the school year so I can kind of get an idea, feel for how full it is and what the sites look like and what your capital plans look like. I know that especially with 179th coming out of the ground, it is does occur over a fairly wide horizon, but eventually there will be impacts that you'll feel. And it's better to get ahead of it and work with your capital projects than it is to sit and try and juggle modular classrooms as a solution. We're mindful of that, and we'll see what we can do to help inform you as early as possible so you can make really well-informed decisions, especially as it pertains to budgeting and bonding.
Right.
Mitch, are you available to speak to school boards, like in a work session? We have one in July that's specifically around facilities and future planning.
Right.
Might be great to have you come out.
It would be wonderful. If we can connect beforehand, yep. That would be great so we can set up an agenda and reinforce it properly.
Yeah, I'll have my secretary give you a call.
Thank you.
So I had a quick question, and maybe it's already been discussed. I'm new. What is the transportation plan, and this might not be this committee, for the county? And I, of course, ask that question because Washougal doesn't have great transportation out to us, but if they were to have a much more robust system, that would impact us significantly. So I'm just kind of wondering, is there a plan for the county in the next 2, 5, 10 years?
So we have a transportation capital facilities plan that's part of our comprehensive plan. Our transportation capital facilities plan is approximately $158 million over the 20 years. It is for projects that are outside city limits, inside most notably inside urban areas, but outside city limits. We can provide you the capital facilities plan and transportation plan.
And then we also have the six-year TIP, which should give you an idea of what's on the six-year horizon. And then,
I think that would be helpful to that list.
Go ahead. So I have a question of the group, completely off today's topic, but pertaining to an earlier of the year topic, measles and your school districts and kind of your ability to manage through that, and are there some opportunities to work with the county, with public? I'm just kind of throwing it out there. We don't have to get into it in detail today, but I just thought it might be a topic somewhere that this group might want to consider or not. But one of the things we talked about on the Board of Health is the system that districts use to monitor immunization rates and whether that's as accurate as it could be. We're not sure that it is, but we don't know the answer. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out and get some just for thought.
Well, I think in a perfect world, we would have a county system where all the immunizations for staff specifically and possibly for students as well was housed. We're doing that internally in our district, probably like everybody else. But when people and children move around, it'd be nice to have that system that we could quickly access. And we have some information that we got from the county. So when I went to my doctors, they had my records in there. We don't have that easily and quickly accessible for all employees. And that's a big concern for us in reference to student achievement. It's not just the students being excluded, but obviously the teachers can't teach.
Right. Right. And that I was speaking to Marnie about this prior to the meeting beginning. I didn't know that it would be an appropriate time since it wasn't on the agenda. But with the passage or potential passage and signing of a bill that's going to require immunizations, that's got to mean that schools have got to make sure that the students are immunized. If that's the case, how will you keep track of it? And can we combine what the health department is able to capture from physicians who give immunizations? Mm-hmm. And in my conversations with Dr. Melnick about this particular issue, the records, he firmly feels that the records, of course, that the physicians give when they give a shot is a more accurate record. And so if there was a way to, but there has been some concern that the school's records really are not, I mean, the school records maybe are better. So if we could combine somehow having those records, and I can, you know, part of the problem is kids moving around and then those records not going with them or whatever. But as you, I think throwing this out is a really good thing for you to start thinking about maybe a way that we could do this so that we have real accurate records. Some are saying that the rates are really not as low as has been stated, but we don't know for sure. My understanding is the physicians that give these immunizations also, I said, does every physician have to be a part of this? Well, not really. They aren't. If they get they get a discount on vaccines if they participate. The cost of vaccines are less to them if they participate. So that would be a real incentive for them to be part of this program, and part of that then requires them to state who has been immunized. But I just think it's something that the school district should be thinking about, how maybe they could implement something that would be, you know, very accurate and maybe, I don't know, transfer with the student. I don't know how big of a, what a gargantuan task it would be to do this, but.
So speaking of gargantuan, so that is attached to dollars. So
yes.
I'm, and I haven't read that bill, the proposed legislation. Do you know if there's any dollars attached to the new mandate for schools that we
no,
hold
I don't
students
think
accountable?
So.
And I missed that point. It's probably important to understand how our health services are funded. Woodland School District with 2,500 kids has about a 0.78 nurse district-wide funding-wise.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what Washougal has, but probably less than one. And so we're limited. That said, we have been transitioning over the last several years to a data system where those records used to exist on paper, and now as kids are aging up, they're all in our data system. So if we get the records from parents, they're
yes,
right there.
But I'm thinking because it's going to be a state law that you cannot enroll unless you have that proof. There, I would figure that somehow that form is going to require a physician's signature or something as well. I don't know if you've thought about this, whether the state would actually propose the kind of form that, but I would think that schools would be the, well, maybe not. The state might require.
It's just a matter of managing the records, right? That's really what we're talking about.
And everyone has access to that state database. So if you looked in the database and the child is in there, you don't need a signed form.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So there's actually only two providers in Clark County that do not participate in the Vaccine for Children program. One of them did not give any vaccine in 2018. My guess is, you know, maybe their population is more gerontology.
Yeah.
And then the other one did 20 doses of measles vaccine in 2018. So they really don't see,
level.
A lot of
children. So I guess in anticipation of implementation of this new legislation, maybe it will become less of an issue if physicians are reporting their vaccinations and it's in a system that school districts can access, then maybe this possible disconnect between reporting systems goes away. I don't know.
And I would guess that for schools, you don't want to look up every student's name in the database. I mean, I'm guessing that's where the challenge is, right? Yeah. So that, I think.
There still will be exemptions.
Exemptions.
Yeah, right.
Medical exemptions.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There will be some.
And I think it still includes a religious exemption.
Religious and medical, I think. Mm-hmm. It's the philosophical and personal.
It would be.
I guess part of the reason that I brought it up was just I think you have a willing Department of Health,
mm-hmm.
And you have a willing council that is open to trying to find ways to help. So if there's something we can do there, we're open and willing to kind of hear what that might be, because we don't know, but you might.
Yeah, I would say they're the appropriate ones to be asking about how could this be better implemented and could it be done. Of course, dollars are always attached, which is why Dr. Melnick said, really, it's a resource issue for the schools. So. Okay. Well, anything else for the good of the order? Okay, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.